This is a Yahoo Finance special, The Biden Presidency, Year One. The White House is eager to point to success, trillions of dollars in new spending for COVID relief and an infrastructure bill, a booming economy, and unemployment under 4%. But those wins are outweighed by some big losses. Build Back Better is a bust so far, and his latest marquee pledge, new voting protections, appears DOA as well. If politics is about pocketbooks, soaring prices are also bad news for Biden. And then there's the pandemic. With his problems mounting and the midterms on the horizon, there are predictions of a wipeout for Democrats in the fall. Join us now for this Yahoo Finance special, The Biden Presidency, Year One. Welcome to this Yahoo Finance special. I'm Adam Shapiro.
And I'm Akiko Fujita. 1 year on, the president faces a very different reality, especially when it comes to those efforts to curb the pandemic. Back in January last year, just 5% of U.S. adults had been vaccinated. More than 3,000 Americans were dying of COVID-19 every day. Those numbers have improved significantly, but there is still a very long road ahead until many Americans are going to feel safe. Joining us now is Yahoo News correspondent Andrew Romano. And Andrew, you know, we're talking about a number of challenges. It feels like things swing from month to month. This month, it's been about testing. It's about getting those vaccines and those boosters. How should we be looking at this year one of the president's performance on the pandemic?
Yeah, Joe Biden came into office saying that he was going to overcome the deadly virus. That has not been the case. He did an excellent job, as you said, speeding those vaccines out, only 5% vaccinated when he took office. Now we've got more than three quarters of the public with at least one dose. The problem is the virus itself keeps changing. The challenges keep changing. The Biden administration has said that they did not see the Delta variant coming. They did not see the Omicron variant coming. And with each of those evolutions in the viruses, the virus has presented a new challenge to the administration right now. Testing is that major challenge. We've seen the long lines over the holidays when Omicron took off. The rapid tests were not available. The PCR tests, long waits made them essentially useless. And so the administration now has shifted, focused on those rapid tests, is sending them out at least four to every household in the United States, but is a little bit behind the curve. And I think that has been the thing about the administration. They have not foreseen what is coming next with this virus. You could say that maybe no one could foresee what was coming next, but they have been a little bit slow to respond, a little bit unclear in the communication. And that has frustrated Americans who just want things to get back to normal. They're seeing, you know, a year later after Biden took office, there are still 2,000 Americans dying every day of COVID. And the fact is we're still in a pandemic. So the challenges change. The administration tries to respond. They're a little bit behind the curve, and people are unhappy about that.
Andrew, quick follow-up. I heard from a senior citizen who's upset that the push to have insurance companies cover the cost of an over-the-counter COVID-19 test.
Yeah.
Medicare doesn't cover it, and yet senior citizens are the most vulnerable and perhaps, you know, most likely, unfortunately, to have a severe outcome if they get sick. So this doesn't make sense. Has the administration addressed that?
It's incredibly frustrating. I think when the administration first was trying to respond to the demand, the vastly increased demand for testing, and Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, came out and said, what are we supposed to do, send it to every American? They came out with a plan to allow you to go through the cumbersome process of getting it reimbursed that by insurance. That's just not going to work for most Americans, and they've basically realized that at this point, with the website to allow every household to order four free tests, that's how simple and easy things need to be to actually combat a surge in the virus. We're seeing that now with the N95 masks. They finally come around to the view that you need medical grade masks, not cloth masks, and that you need to provide those, make those easy and accessible for Americans at pharmacies, at community health centers, for free, not going online and trying to figure out, is this a fake one? Is this a real one? What Amazon, you know, vendor should I order it from? So they're coming around to this view that they've got to make it as frictionless as possible for Americans. But it's not going to do much to combat Omicron at this point. We're already sort of turning the corner on the surge itself. And so it's a little bit, it's the right idea, but again, it's a little bit behind the curve.
Andrew, thank you. We're going to keep talking about this, but we're going to bring into the stream former American Medical Association President, Dr. Patrice Harris. And very simply, Doctor, from your viewpoint, what is the administration doing correctly?
Well, thank you for having me. And certainly, we applaud the Biden administration for doing what it can to get the testing out, the mask out, as you just heard, because from the very beginning of this pandemic, and it seems that we would, as a country, focus on one thing. We might be focused on masks, or we might be focused on testing, even though we, of course, from the very beginning did not have the testing capacity. And really, it's about all, using all tools in the toolbox and not forgetting one and not becoming enamored with one. It is masking. It is testing from the very beginning. I have advocated for testing before I co-founded EMED, as you know, as president of the American Medical Association, talked about the importance of testing and the frustration with the long lines and the inequitable access to testing. So I believe they're getting it right regarding testing. Again, we've been behind the eight ball on testing since the beginning, and they're getting it right on mask and, you know, and funding is the right thing to do.
Dr. Harris, when you think about this most recent surge from the Omicron variant, it feels like there's been a bit of a shift from, you know, trying to crack down or quash the pandemic to actually learning to live with this virus. How does that shift change up the approach for the White House, or how should it?
Well, you know, we had the Delta surge and now we have the Omicron surge. And it appears, although I tell you, I'm uncomfortable with using words like letting up. You know, as a physician, a former public health official, I think we need to actually keep our feet on the gas pedal, to use another metaphor. Certainly, Omicron is less deadly, more transmissible, but still, again, as you noted in the opening, we have thousands of people dying every day. So we should not be letting up. I've said this virus gets an A plus at doing what viruses do. Viruses mutate. You can't predict how they will mutate, but we know that viruses do mutate. And that's why, again, we need to make sure, again, to be a bit more proactive. You know, we talked about working to prevent pandemics, we need to also make sure we are working through a pandemic to continue to do the things, testing, masking, thinking about testing in schools and in the workplaces, all the public health measures that we know work.
Dr. Harris, you know far better than we do, but we've had guests on the platform who've said, look, by March or April, they use that term, we can let up. What I hear you saying is, no, we need to stay at kind of the level we're at now, but there doesn't seem to be an end.
So let me say this, there will be an end. I do believe, as many public health officials and physicians believe, that we will get to the point where this is endemic, right? And we think about this just like we think about the flu, right? We have the flu season and we have flu campaigns. We want everyone to get vaccinated. So that will happen. However, right now, we are still in the midst. We have the Omicron. So this will end. I am hopeful that this will end, but actions will be required for this to end. I mean, it won't end magically or on its own. We as a society have to continue to do the things. Now, clearly, we are not where we were a year ago. Because we have the vaccine, everyone should get vaccinated and boosted that's eligible. We have masks, and I really do, again, applaud the administration for getting the correct mask out there. Testing works and is a critical piece. We will need to be strategic and targeted in our testing. We will need to make sure we have the data regarding the test results. So we should be able to look back at this investment and say, here's what we know. Certainly there are some opportunities where you just want to test, you just want to know, but there are others where you need the data and you want systems like our platform at EMED so that you can keep up with the data. And if we take those actions, We will end this pandemic, but it won't happen magically, and it won't happen without our action, our collective action.
Appreciate your joining us. Dr. Patrice Harris is the co-founder and CEO of eMed, as well as a former president of the American Medical Association. All the best to you. We're going to take a quick commercial break, but when we come back, unemployment is down, wages are up, but so is inflation. So we're going to ask the White House's top economic advisor for some clarity on the mixed picture regarding the U.S. economy. That's next.
The Federal Reserve provided extraordinary support during the crisis for the previous year and a half. Given the strength of our economy and the pace of recent price increases, it's appropriate, as the Federal Chairman Powell has indicated, to recalibrate the support that is now necessary.
That was President Biden speaking at a press conference yesterday, highlighting the Federal Reserve's mandate of price stability. Now, by all accounts, the president has overseen a strong economy in his first year in office. 6.4 million jobs created, unemployment down, wages are up, and yet inflation at near 40-year highs have continued to plague the White House. We had a chance to speak with White House National Economic Council Director Brian Deese earlier today and asked him how the administration plans to tackle that problem of price pressures. Take a listen.
Well, I think looking back with context, 2021 was a historic economic year. The strongest job growth on record, the largest decline in unemployment in our nation's history, and the strongest economic growth in nearly four decades. In addition, we saw a 40% reduction in child poverty, a reduction in hunger, and an improvement in households' balance sheets that is unique to America. We're only seeing that happen in the U.S. And so we think that if you're looking back, we've seen really historic progress. And at the same time, we have challenges and work yet unfinished. The elevated price increases we've seen are clearly an issue, and what the president spoke directly to yesterday was the appropriate role for the Federal Reserve to play in dialing back some of the historic support it has been providing to the economy, and the role that he can play in trying to help boost the productive capacity of our economy so we can move more goods and services through our economy more cheaply and build on this historic progress that we've made.
Hey, Brian, it was Will Rogers who said, "I'm not a member of any organized political party. I'm a Democrat."
And I quote that from the last century, because these days, when we talk about, for instance, Build Back Better, and you've just highlighted the accomplishments of the first year, which include the $1.9 trillion relief from the pandemic, the infrastructure bill. How do you get the Democrats who are, you know, have one part of the party saying all or nothing? You have two senators who are saying we're not going to amend in any way a filibuster. How does the president build cohesion, even if you're going to build break out parts of Build Back Better, to get that through both houses?
Well, I think we do it by taking the approach the president outlined yesterday, which is identifying all of the areas where we can get support, build them together, get that done, and then keep working where we don't have it. And the good news is that broadly across Democrats and the American people, there is broad support for taking steps that will help address the costs that families are facing on prescription drugs, on health care, on child care, on reducing energy prices by investing in clean energy. In all of those areas, there is broad support. And to your Will Rogers point, I think that the more striking contrast here is all of those areas are areas where Democrats agree and the American people agree. They're common sense, they would reduce costs, and we don't see any Republicans supporting that. And frankly, we don't see the Republicans supporting any real concrete plan to deal with the price increases that we're facing. So that's the way we're going to approach this. And the president has long experience in bringing coalitions together. It is never easy. It is never quick and immediate. That was not the path that we took in getting a historic bipartisan infrastructure deal done last year, but that's the path we're going to keep at here, and we're confident we're going to get something done.
With that said, Brian, there seems to be an increasing concession here that this large package, roughly $2 trillion, is not going to be able to pass in its complete form. We heard the president yesterday talking about potentially breaking up the pieces. Is the climate bill the priority right now, the roughly $500 billion? If you don't have the support for the child tax credit, free community colleges, is the priority for the White House right now to move forward with at least a big chunk of this bill so you have something to take to the voters and say, look, we got this done?
Well, the president made very clear his priority is identifying all the areas where we can find agreement, getting that done, and then continuing to work where we don't yet have agreement. And so that's exactly what we're going to do. And the need for investing in clean energy, having a more resilient energy system here in the United States that produces cheaper zero carbon energy here in the United States is a priority. Lowering the cost of childcare and healthcare and prescription drugs is a priority. These issues are hard, but we think we can get agreement on those. And even on an issue like the child tax credit, the president made clear that's going to be tough, but he also made clear he really prioritizes it because what it does is it puts money directly in the hands of American families who are dealing with costs right now and empowers them by giving them a tax cut. So we're going to, wherever we can get agreement, we're going to put this together and we're going to try to get it done.
There are possibilities with Senator Manchin, who suggested a deal on climate provisions. What would that look like, hypothetically? You and the president are in the Oval Office having a discussion with the senator. What's that look like? How do you get him to say yes to something as you break it out of the bigger package?
Well, Senator Manchin is a partner, and one of the things that we're not going to do is to try to negotiate this out in public or characterize those conversations, that it's important that we maintain those lines of communications, and we do so respectfully and privately. But what I can tell you is that the core focus is on what are the impacts of these provisions on the lives and livelihoods of the American people, and how are they responsive to the current economic challenges that we face? So investments in clean energy, providing long-term incentives to the market in a technology-neutral way that will drive America to be a leader in generating the new clean energy technologies of the future, whether that be wind and solar or nuclear and carbon capture and sequestration, that is a big economic priority and a big win for our economy and our workers if we can get that right. We have an opportunity to do so in this package with provisions that have we spent a lot of time working with industry and with other stakeholders to get right. So that's a place where I think we can make a lot of progress.
Let's talk about where things stand in the pandemic, because it feels like there's been a bit of a shift in tone from the president to 1 year ago when he said we're going to beat this virus to today where he's saying we're going to learn to live with the virus. If you look at this from the economic picture, I mean, the supply shortages, price pressures, that's all come along with this. So To what extent can all that be controlled when you've still got the virus sort of looming in the background?
Well, this is a pandemic-driven crisis, and this recovery is marked by the intersection between the pandemic and the economy, no doubt about it. But you also heard the president loud and clear yesterday saying he does not accept the idea that the current normal is what we are going to live with. And in fact, we are making progress toward an outcome where COVID is not affecting everybody's daily lives and constraining our economy in fundamental ways. And we're making real progress toward that goal. We're not there yet, but we're making real progress. And as we progress on the virus, it helps progress on the economy as well. That's been true when we came into office. It was true last month. It'll be true next month as well. But that's why you see the president focusing on things like our supply chains, where working with business and labor to try to open up our ports, open up our railways and our trucking lines to move more goods through this economy. That's really important to do, and it's important to do in a way that helps minimize the impact of the virus and maximize the ability to move goods and services through this economy. I'll say today we're releasing a dashboard that shows that the number of containers that are sitting on docks for a long period of time is down 60% since November. Even during the high holiday shopping season, that was because of hard work by port operators and companies across the private sector supply chain and our administration working in partnership with them. And that's the kind of thing we're going to keep at going forward.
And our thanks to White House National Economic Council Director Brian Deese for speaking to us earlier today. Coming up, we're talking about the 2022 midterm elections, how the Democrats can hold their grip on power come November. We're going to speak to Brad Woodhouse, who's former campaign advisor to President Obama. That conversation is straight ahead. Yeah, Adam, it looks like you're muted. I'm going to pick
Sorry
up
about
here.
That.
You are watching Yahoo Finance's special presentation of the Biden presidency year one. President Biden struggling to deliver on his agenda, his Build Back Better, certainly broken apart, and there could be more trouble on the horizon if American voters produce a red wave come November. Let's bring in Yahoo News chief national correspondent, John Ward. And John, we've always seen the pendulum swing back in these midterm elections. How big of a swing are we looking at?
Hey, yeah, I mean, there is a lot of history behind this. You're right. We saw some of that swing already in Virginia last fall with Glenn Youngkin winning the governorship in Virginia and Republicans taking back the half of the state legislature. I think the big question here is, can Republicans take back both the House and the Senate? The House looks pretty gettable for them. It's a 10-seat differential. They only need to pick up six, I believe. The Senate is close. Obviously, most people know that it's a 50-50 split, and Vice President Harris breaks those ties in favor of Democrats right now. So Republicans don't need to win a lot of seats to regain the majority in the Senate. You know, one of the things Democrats have going for them is that all 14 of the seats they're defending went for Biden in 2020. So there are a couple seats that are going to be tough for them to win, but they also have some seats where they could potentially pick up what has been a Republican seat. It's looking undoubtedly like a Republican wave. That's kind of a foregone conclusion. That I think the question is how big and how much Biden and Democrats can recover between now and this fall.
John, talking about recovering between now and the fall, the perceptions don't necessarily mirror the facts on the table. So if you're a candidate who's running, say, for a House seat, you know what the opposition, if you're a Democrat, is going to throw at you. How do you respond to it? I mean, defund the police is going to get thrown at some of the candidates. How should the Democrats respond?
Well, I mean, if we're talking about House races, those are always pretty specific to the district. Senate races are more statewide, more nationalized. I think one of the big things Republicans are going to hit Democrats for is, just basic kitchen table issues. The inflation issue is going to be massive. So that's kind of an X factor for Democrats. How much can they get that under control? How much control do they even have over it? That was obviously a big part of your conversation with Brian Deese. I know Democrats are going to do their best to avoid stepping into culture war hot button issues like defund the police. I'm sure that will come up to some degree. I personally don't sense as much of that right now from Republican messaging. I think Democrats are going to need to focus on what they've done that makes a difference in people's lives. And that comes back to the same type of issue that inflation hits, which is, quality of life, pocketbook. They're going to have to talk about ways that the recovery plan from COVID and the infrastructure bill have made a real impact on people's lives. So far, they haven't done a lot of that. And I think you're going to see a big push to correct that.
Okay, John Ward, I know you're going to be all over that story going into November. Yahoo News chief national correspondent joining us there. Let's bring in senior DNC advisor and former Obama campaign advisor Brad Woodhouse for more context here. Brad, good to talk to you today. Democrats have certainly been in this position before. If you think about the first term of the Obama administration, what's going to be different this time around?
Well, look, it's tough. I acknowledge that. I mean, one thing that seems to be a pattern is that Democratic presidents inherit terrible economies and terrible circumstances from Republicans, and it takes a long time to fix those problems. Sometimes you don't fix them fast enough before the next election. I would say in this case, I think we've made a tremendous amount of progress, and I agree with John that what Democrats need to do, in addition to working on Build Back Better, the chunks or the pieces that we can get done, working on inflation, continuing to work to put the pandemic in the rearview mirror, we got to talk about the things that we've done. We've accomplished a lot. Historic number of jobs created. We, of course, got to 75% of people vaccinated. We're literally delivering masks and tests into people's homes. And so we got to go out and talk about the things that we've done. And the other thing that we'll be able to do is Democrats and almost no Republican will be able to stand in front of groundbreakings that are funded by the bipartisan infrastructure bill.
Really?
If we do all that, I think we can do better than people think we can.
Brad, you just open the door on this, and you talk about what the Democrats have done. What about attacking the Republicans who are now actually taking credit those who voted against, I'm thinking of one, I think it's Iowa, and one from Texas, who are taking credit for monies that are going to infrastructure projects in their districts, and they voted against the infrastructure bill. Where's the DNC attack ad?
Well, look, you're going to see it, and I think you're going to see it, and you're going to see those ads in those races, and you're going to see those ads locally, and those ads are going to come out of super PACs. We jumped all over that news and really hyped that and tried to get that into the media bloodstream about these members who voted against the infrastructure bill and then go and put out press releases and put stuff on their website trying to take credit for it. And I think the president was right yesterday. We have got to call out Republicans when they do that kind of thing. And then Democrats have got to say to Republicans, what are you for? Why don't you want to lower prescription drug prices? Why don't you want to lower health care costs? Why don't you want to lower child care costs? Why don't you want to lower energy costs? And I think if Republicans go into the election only trying to sabotage the president and have no agenda of their own, I don't think they're going to do as well as they're acting like they're going to do.
Brad, you started by talking about the fact that Democratic presidents have, in your words, inherited bad economies from Republicans. But the economy is actually in a good spot under President Biden. If you look at the overall data, we've talked about the millions of jobs created, unemployment at 3.9%, wages are going up. And yet the president just can't escape that inflation headline. Why do you think the message on the positives aren't sticking?
Well, look, I think people are frustrated. The president mentioned this yesterday. There are two things that are going on right now that we have to wrap our hands around. That's inflation, and that's the pandemic and this variant that we need to get behind us. And hopefully we won't have more variants like that. So those two things are, I think, creating this concern among voters. And they're not hearing and seeing the other things. Part of that is that we've all been involved in the hats that I wear. We've been involved in trying to get Build Back Better passed. We've been involved in trying to get voting rights passed. And now we're going to have to split our attention. We're going to have to continue to try to pass those things, but we got to go out and talk about the things that we have accomplished. Yes, the economy is doing really well right now, with the exception of inflation, but it wasn't when we came in, and we got to make that case. We got to make the case that we were 6.5% unemployment and now at 3.9%, that record job creation, more than any other year in history since we've been tracking, and what we've done and what we're getting ready to do to deliver masks, deliver tests, and continue to deliver vaccines. We got to go out and take credit for what we've done.
You know, in the DNC discussions, what are the three top issues that voting Americans care about?
Well, I think it's jobs. It's jobs. It is inflation, so we need to get a handle on that. And it's showing leadership on getting this pandemic behind us. But right below that are issues like democracy and voting rights and making sure that people have a fair access to the ballot. But I think it's always the case that when it comes to people's economic lives, whether it's the jobs they have, the wages, which we do see going up, healthcare costs. I do think the number one issue we see over and over and over again in the polls is the high cost of healthcare, particularly prescription drugs. And, you know, you got like 90% of Americans want to deal with that, but every Republican is against it. So we've got to make that contrast. And that's one issue we really do have to get done in whatever the future is for Build Back Better.
Brad Woodhouse, thank you so much for joining us today for this special on the one-year anniversary of the Biden administration. Up next, why Texas Congressman Kevin Brady says President Biden is helping raise the cost of living in America. Brady will join us right after the break. And the latest CPI reading, when we talk about inflation, shows it was up a whopping 7% over the last year. And many are laying the blame squarely on President Joe Biden. Now, this comes as the White House continues to make the case for its Build Back Better plan, which some people say will drive inflation higher. So joining us now is Texas Congressman and House Ways and Means Committee ranking member Kevin Brady. It's good to see you. And I just want to quote the title of a note that you put out to your constituency is that President Biden's first year, America's economy was poised for greatness in 2021. How did Biden bungle it this badly? Where would you like to begin? Because we just had a member of the DNC defending this first year.
Yeah, so we obviously have pretty significant differences with your previous guest here, and here's why. So, look, the bounce back from 2020, which was a tough year, so the economic rebound beat expectations, was very strong coming into 2021. The other advantages was life-saving vaccines. There were trillions of dollars of bipartisan COVID relief coursing through the economy, and major regions of the country were finally reopening. So 2021 should have been a banner year. But what got delivered was the president fell short of expectations each of the three quarters. And I predict a fourth when those numbers come in. He's about 1.1 million jobs short of his promises from the COVID stimulus in March. Inflation has wiped out 3 years of wage gains for average Americans. That's crushing. I mean, we've still got a serious worker shortage that is really damaging Main Street businesses in a big way. Economic optimism has really plunged, both from small businesses and families here over the last year. And so right now, every poll seems to show that Americans are questioning the president's ability to lead on the economy. And I think there's good reason for it.
Let's talk about the worker shortage specifically. I mean, if we're talking about unemployment at 3.9%, no question businesses have said, look, we just can't find the workers there despite the incentives in place. But you're talking about 3.9%, near full employment. So what do you think the Biden administration is doing wrong? What more can they do or should they do to improve the labor market, given where things stand?
Yeah, that's a great question. Unfortunately, 3.9% is low for the wrong reasons. It's because we've got between 2 and 4 million people who've left the workforce voluntarily. That's not a good sign. As we've talked before, there were a number of provisions in the COVID stimulus that discouraged Americans from reconnecting to work, including a new revamped child credit, tax credit that for the first time no longer required Americans to have earnings at all. That, our local business told us, became another barrier after those very lavish federal unemployment benefits. The ACA subsidies, the Affordable Care Act subsidies, were equally untied to work and went up to $500,000 or more. That became another barrier. If made permanent, experts had predicted that that could incentivize about 2 million Americans to exit the workforce permanently. And so I think they made this worker shortage worse. We are still rebounding from it. And just as inflation, they initially denied it, then dismissed it, now blame it on the Fed. But the policies of the president in Congress in this one-party rule worsened inflation as well. And what I'm worried about right now is we have the makings of a wage price spiral that is very tough to tame and usually ends badly. And no one in either party wants to see that happen.
When we talk about inflation, one of the things that Republicans have pointed to is the tremendous amount of spending. You just alluded to the $1.9 trillion relief bill that was passed at the beginning of the administration. But then there's the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill. And I think it was only 13 Republicans in the House actually voted in favor of it. Some called it socialist liberal spending. And I'm thinking of a colleague of yours from Texas who's now touting the fact that some of this money is going to be used to build projects in her district. What do you say to Republicans who voted against infrastructure, calling it socialist spending, but are now saying, woohoo, we've got some money, let's go?
Yeah, so I would note in that case in Fort Worth that Congresswoman Kay Granger had already passed earlier in a Republican majority funding for that project as well. And so it has a long record of delivering there. And secondly, I think as Republicans, we're kind of familiar with this. As we saw Democrats, everyone who voted against giving seniors a prescription drug program, take credit for those medicines, life-saving medicines for our seniors. So this is unfortunately not unusual. And I think at the end of the day, Republicans in the House were, overwhelmingly willing to work on a bipartisan infrastructure bill. We weren't asked to do that at all. And in the House, unlike the Senate, it was tied directly to $2 trillion of tax hikes, which obviously is crippling the economy in America, landed on small businesses and job creators, and I think would have driven a lot of jobs overseas. So unlike the Senate, the roads and the higher taxes on small businesses were tied together.
Congressman, really quickly, we heard the president yesterday step up his attacks against Republicans, saying it really is all about obstruction, but there's not a unifying message here that Republicans take to voters. What do you say when people say, what do the Republicans stand for come midterms?
Yeah, well, one, we would be happy to work with this president on a number of issues, including a trade, making America medically independent from China in a number of areas. I think there's work on retirement security and making America more internationally competitive as well. But we haven't had a single invitation to sit down from this president or Speaker Pelosi in the House to do exactly that. And so I disagree with his claim that no one will work with him. He's been very clear. He's not very interested, and certainly Speaker Pelosi is not as well. I think our message will be that we have to have a country that doesn't lurch from crisis to crisis, that we have to resolve the crisis on the border, which for our states like Texas is just so damaging. We have to address this crime wave in a significant way. We've got to address inflation and the worker shortage, or we'll never see the strong economic growth we had pre-COVID, which I'm convinced we can restore, but it won't be from higher taxes and huge government spending. I think it's going to be smart spending, a trimmer budget, and frankly, continuing to reduce taxes on job creators.
Well, Congressman Kevin Brady, we always appreciate you joining us here on Yahoo Finance. Thanks so much for the time today.
It's good to see you.
Well, coming up, we are going to continue to have that conversation about the president's inflation challenge. My interview with Arizona Senator Mark Kelly is on the other side. We'll be right back. And welcome back to our Yahoo Finance special, the Biden presidency year one. Growing price pressures have continued to plague the president, with his approval rating now at just 40%, despite a strong labor market. I asked Arizona Senator Mark Kelly about the president's inflation challenge and what he thinks the president needs to do to bring down those costs.
I mean, these rising costs are really hurting Arizona families and families across the country. But it's not just here in the United States. I mean, we've seen European countries, experience similar issues when supply chains get disrupted, like they have over the last couple of years. I mean, that contributes to shortages. And as we know, that's going to result in rising prices.
You've pressed the administration specifically to take steps to lower the cost of food. And you've spoken specifically about what you've described as corporate price gouging that's happening. Is that what you think is happening here?
For some issues, yeah, absolutely. Just this week, the Secretary of Agriculture, Secretary Vilsack, came out to Arizona a couple of days ago. I was with him meeting with some ranchers in Glendale, Arizona, but the ranchers came from all over the state. Ranchers are getting the same amount for their beef that they did, before the pandemic. But the prices have gone up. So what is causing that? They're not getting more for their product. The consumers are now paying in Arizona anyway about $5 a pound for ground beef. So something is happening in where the product goes from the ranch to the market. So I have the administration looking into this. I mean, is it the processors? What is causing prices to go up? And, food is becoming, it's really challenging for many Arizona families to buy groceries right now, and it has to be dealt with.
What are you hearing from those constituents, the ranchers that you just alluded to? How much have they seen costs go up, and what's the reality for their businesses?
Yeah, I mean, the price of corn and alfalfa, the price of diesel fuel. So their expenses have gone up, but their revenue is flat. They should be, benefiting, from some of the price increases. I mean, we don't want the prices to go up. We want Arizona families and families across the country to be able to afford groceries. This has been really challenging. But there's something specific to this, and I think this is going on in other industries where you have big corporations that are taking certain steps to increase their profits on the backs of the American people.
So let's talk about the steps that you have proposed to try and bring things down. You talked about bringing down the cost of food, but also addressing the snags that we're seeing in the supply chain, specifically in the labor shortage in the trucking industry. You've called for the need to expand the pool of prospective drivers, but how do you actually do that? This is something that we saw even before the pandemic. And some would argue there's a bit of a generational shift that's happening. Not enough people wanting to get into this industry anymore.
Yeah, it's true. It's these are good paying jobs, but they also require that you leave your family for, in some cases, good periods of time. It's challenging work. And right now, I mean, we've got a shortage of employees across the country. The workforce, we had over, about 1.5 million additional Americans retire than expected during the pandemic. That's a lot of people that just disappeared out of our workforce. There are certainly some things you can do. You can provide training opportunities that are more readily available to young people. You can reduce the age for folks to get jobs where they're driving on interstate highways from state to state. Right now, that age is 21. We are looking into reducing that to 18. You got to make sure you have the right people. You got to make sure you train them well. And they're going to, do the job in a responsible way. But there are steps we can take to alleviate that supply chain issue.
And you can catch my full conversation with Senator Mark Kelly on our website, yahoofinance.com. Coming up, we grade President Biden's foreign policy in his first year in the White House, the tricky path he faces as he looks to navigate some of those geopolitical landmines. That's up ahead.
President Biden's first year in office has been littered with one foreign policy headache after another. There was the messy exit from Afghanistan, the ongoing tension with China, and of course, Russia's growing ambitions in its own backyard, its aggressions towards Ukraine. To discuss the challenges ahead, we invite into the stream Professor Susan Ashton Thornton, former Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs and a professor at Yale. Thank you for being here. And what is, not looking back, but looking forward, the most urgent foreign affairs issue for the Biden administration? Is it Russia and is it the situation with Ukraine?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say, Adam, that it is the situation with Russia right now. I mean, we've got Tony Blinken is in Europe trying to solve this problem. It's really unfortunate that this crisis has been sort of generated by the Russians. The timing is a little bit odd, not really explainable, and they've given us a very short deadline. So they're manufacturing basically an atmosphere of crisis. And so I think it is something that is going to take the full attention right now.
What's the report card you'd give the administration on its handling of this issue?
Well, I think this is an issue where the administration's been pretty reactive. I mean, this crisis with Ukraine in some ways has been going on for quite a long time, probably really since the end of the Soviet Union, certainly since 2014 when Crimea was taken by the Russians. But, you know, the reason that it's coming up now in such an urgent way is really driven by Vladimir Putin. And I think what I'd like to see is a little bit more sort of scope for diplomacy being given from both sides. I mean, both sides have kind of said that their positions are immutable, and that doesn't really leave much space for diplomacy. It's not really clear how we can get out of that without the conflict that Vladimir Putin seems to be promising us he has up his sleeve.
So let's move a little bit south from Russia and take a look at China. The relations with China, troubling. And a lot of people, you would know better than those of us who worry about it, but there's talk that maybe China makes a move on Taiwan. Where do we stand in that, and how would the U.S. respond? Is it even a real potential threat?
Well, I think the Chinese have a lot of reasons to be looking to try to maintain some stability in the Taiwan Strait over certainly the next year and several years. They're not looking for a fight in Taiwan. And I think there's been a lot of chatter, if you will, kind of mutual recriminations about Taiwan between the US and China. But I think after the last meeting between President Biden and Xi Jinping in China, there was a certain stabilizing effect where basically, Xi Jinping said that China will be patient and wants to pursue peaceful efforts there. And the U.S. has reiterated its longstanding policy, which has been so successful with respect to Taiwan for the last 40 years. So I'm hopeful that certainly this year in 2022, there's big things on the domestic calendar for both the U.S. and China. So I'm not looking to see that there's going to be a conflict over Taiwan in the immediate future.
Specifically on China, on the one hand, it feels like the Biden administration has continued the policies of the Trump administration, maybe not with the same rhetoric, but along the same path. And yet we've heard the president say consistently, this is about competition, but there are areas for cooperation, like issues on climate. You think they can continue to toe that line, especially given Xi's growing power? When you think about the end of the year, he's up for a third term yet again. Can the U.S. continue to sort of navigate this in the way they have, at least in the first year of the administration?
Yeah, I mean, the way I kind of characterize what's happened in the first year is it's a sort of a drift between the U.S. and China. Really, the Biden administration has focused on domestic strengthening and rebuilding relations with our allies, following on some damage that was done by the previous administration, rejoining international institutions like the Paris Climate Accord, for example, and really hasn't been very specific about what it's going to do with China. You know, we have a lingering trade war, really, that's not been altered in any way under the Biden administration. The tariffs are still there. So it's really kind of been minimal communication, working in these other areas and letting the China approach kind of drift. I think in the next year in 2022, and maybe even following that in 2023, there may be some chances to do a bit more substantively in terms of with China on issues that you mentioned, like climate change, maybe some other transnational issues. But for right now, I think the Biden administration's really focused in on, you know, the domestic strengthening, working on some, you know, aspects of support for U.S. industry that they feel, you know, needs to be more competitive with the view toward China's future, you know, developments in technology, et cetera. Working with the allies on that project, trying to sort of work with others to build a coalition to kind of contain and isolate China in areas that they're concerned about. And so it seems to not really be working with China so much at this point.
We appreciate your joining us for this look at not only the first year of the Biden administration, but also a look ahead. Susan Ashton Thornton is a former Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs and a professor at Yale University. We also want to thank you for joining us. This does it for our Yahoo Finance special. We appreciate your watching.